Okay, so here's the format or the plan that I have for tonight, if that's okay. As I said, I'm just gonna give some facts. So for the first 45 to 50 minutes, if you don't mind, save your questions for the last half hour or comments. Both are really important. And I'll tell you a little bit about me first. So if there's no objection, we can go ahead, because I don't mind interruptions that much, but once I get into a flow, it's frustrating if I have to stop. But there'll be plenty of time, I can assure you. I leave time for this. I am a psychiatric survivor, a member of the Coalition Against Psychiatric Assault, few people here are, which I helped to start in 2007 with Dr. Bonnie Roberto, who's senior lecturer here at OISE in the Department of Adult Education and Counseling. I feel very strongly, as she does, about this so-called psychiatric treatment called electroconvulsive therapy, which actually, as I will explain a bit more or mention, has increased. Some people didn't even know what's going on after seeing the film One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and they're so surprised. Even PhDs who might meet, which is at times that experts in the healthcare system say, you mean it's still going on? Yes, it's still going on, unfortunately. So I have vowed to do for the rest of my life to do whatever I can to stop what I consider a serious crime, a human rights violation of the first order. And I've been involved in setting up the first self-help group of psychiatric survivors in Ontario called On Our Own, which doesn't exist anymore, but I'm very pleased that a bunch of us helped to start it back in 1977 with no funding, I should add, so. And we survived for 19 years. But as far as electroshock, what got me interested, I should also tell you that I was locked up for almost a year and a half, going through an identity crisis, didn't know what I wanted to do, like most people who are in their adolescence, 18, 19, 20, 21 years old. And I was a mouthy kid, and I talked back, and I wasn't going to take any shit from anybody, and I still don't. But that was too much for my parents. That was during the Korean War, and they locked me up in McLean Hospital, which is affiliated with Harvard, and they gave me some so-called state-of-the-art insulin shock, which is close. It's also a convulsive treatment, but they don't use electricity. They just shoot a lot of insulin into you until you go into a coma, or just before you go into a coma. Some of you may have seen the film A Beautiful Mind, which featured insulin coma shock. Fortunately, I didn't have the comas, though I once went into it. Anyway, so I am a so-called recipient and survivor of convulsive therapy, the psychiatrists haven't disowned or haven't denounced, which they should have. I'll have to put on my glasses so I can read a bit. Okay. What got me interested in electroshock was mainly when I worked once as a psychologist. I'm not particularly proud of that. I should say psychologist, not psychiatrist, at Queen Street Mental Health Center, which is now called CAMH. And I was there for 2 years, and I had seen people who had shock. I didn't witness it. And even before then, I used to give psychological tests to people who had shock. And what struck me was this so-called organic pattern, which means a something you'd associate with head injury or brain damage, where there is are severe drops on the visual motor parts of the scale. So I started to ask, what the hell is going on? These test results are similar, and as far as I know, they weren't in an automobile accident or didn't have a disease, a real disease of the brain, any brain, yet the test pattern of people who had electroshock was strikingly similar to what you would expect if people had head injury. At that time, and still to this day, they don't give you, if you're scheduled for an ECT, which, and I'll explain the procedure very shortly, they don't give MRIs or CAT scans before or after the shock. So it's like covering up the evidence. If they were to give people an MRI, a brain scan before shock and after, they would find the damage, but they don't. And you can read the position paper of the Canadian Psychiatric Association, which conspicuously leaves that little medical diagnostic fact out. They're not looking for brain damage. Surprise, surprise, that's why they don't find it. And that's a paraphrase from a neurologist in the United States. Look for it, you'll find it. Okay, here's why I'm saying what I'm saying. Consider this procedure, which I virtually have memorized, and I've said it over and over again. It's like rote. Before people get electroconvulsive therapy, or ECT, which I prefer to call electroshock, because that's closer to the reality, because it's shocking people by electricity. They're supposed to not eat or drink anything for another 10 hours or 12 hours before, and then they give you a sedative like a sleeping pill or a tranquilizer, a minor tranquilizer. Then they give you a sedative to put you to sleep, and while you're asleep, they give you a muscle paralyzer, which they call a muscle relaxant. Excuse me, it's not a relaxant, because this drug called succinylcholine is so strong, it paralyzes the breathing apparatus in your chest, which is the diaphragm. So you can't breathe during the procedure. That's why they give you the oxygen. During the procedure, they put a mask over you like you're in surgery. And then they attach the electrodes while you're asleep. And a lot of apologists think shock is safer because you're asleep. Well, I've got news for them. Anyway, they put the electrodes on either side of the head, and sometimes two electrodes on both sides. And the electrodes are coated in electrical jelly, so that makes it easy for the electricity to go through to the brain. And then they turn the current on. The current is more than comes out of the electrical outlet in this room. This room and most rooms and homes have 120 watts coming out. I'm sorry, I'm not a physicist, but most outlets, excluding what goes on in hospitals and industrial plants, generally it's 120 watts, okay? The current today, on average, is 150 to 300 volts. Sorry, volts, I meant to say volts, not watts. You can see I'm not a physicist or an engineer. 150 to 300 volts. The shock machines, you can see one. I brought a picture of one, which from an ad in a psychiatric journal, are capable today of generating up to 450 volts. This is acceptable by psychiatry and the medical profession, apparently, because none of them have lodged any complaint about too much energy coming out of the machine. So this goes through your head for about 2 seconds to 8 seconds maximum, and it causes a coma. So you're in a coma for 10 to 20 minutes. That's why they take you to the recovery room. So they wheel you in on a gurney, flat. Then when you're while you're unconscious or asleep, they wheel you into another room where you can wake up, usually 20 minutes later. When you wake up, and this is important, the immediate effects of every ECT or shock treatment are memory loss, disorientation, which translates into sometimes you don't know your name when you wake up or where you are, much less the date. Nausea, physical weakness, and muscle weakness. Oh, I forgot one more thing, a seizure, because you don't need that much electricity, 300 volts, to trigger a seizure. This seizure is an epileptic type of seizure, I repeat. The seizure, yes, you will find it admitted as such by the Canadian Psychiatric Association and the American Psychiatric Association in their position papers. But guess what? They call it therapeutic. Since when is an epileptic seizure caused by electricity or anything else therapeutic? It's the neurologists who do everything possible to stop you from having a seizure. That's why they give people who have epilepsy anticonvulsant pills to stop it or to minimize it. Not in psychiatry. And this is one of the big lies which I'm going to expose before we get into the global movement, virtually global movement, to stop this atrocity masquerading as a medical treatment for depression. Therapeutic seizure, that's an oxymoron. One cancels out the other. How can a seizure, no one's explained to me, and I'd like to hear this from the lips of a neurologist and specialist, how can a seizure be helpful? In psychiatry, it goes unchallenged. Before I go on, I'd like to read, unless someone wants to volunteer, a statement by an anonymous person, a woman, whom some of you know, but she wants to remain anonymous. And before that, I think I'll read a poem by Neera Fleischman, a very good friend who tragically died 1985 while she was editor of Phoenix Rising magazine, which put out a special shock issue, and I've got it up there. And she calls this poem ECT, because Neera lived on a ward where she saw one of her best friends or others shot. So I want to read an excerpt from the poem because it's a little long. ECT by Neera Fleischman. Expert in public propaganda, they go to work on me, convinced of euphemism, sure of number, determined both will burn the terror splashed upon my face. They try out some occupational tricks, experiment. They think it clever to baptize torture with initials. They think it subtle to call it treatment. They talk of cures, reciting tales of miraculous salvation. I don't buy it. I don't buy it. I've seen the disaster, the mistakes. I call it electrocution. That is an excerpt from ECT. And by the way, women are the main targets of electroshock, and I'll give you a few stats for those of you who like statistics, particularly elderly women. So we're talking about a procedure that is ageist, is sexist and ageist. Because roughly 70% of the shock recipients of ECT survivors are women. This was a submission to the Food and Drug Administration, which was ruling on how to classify shock machines in the United States in January of this year, pretty recent. Public hearings. You don't often hear about public hearings about shock in Canada, I can tell you that. But this was in the United States. This is by a shock survivor who she chooses to remain anonymous, which I absolutely respect. And this is all, quote, "I was just an ordinary middle-aged woman with ordinary problems of life. At age 58, I had developed insomnia and was given a benzodiazepine for it. I had an adverse reaction which no one recognized as such. My insomnia became worse, and I also became agitated. I was then diagnosed with agitated depression and prescribed a seemingly never-ending list of pharmaceuticals, 35 in total in less than 8 months, which were to treat my insomnia and so-called depression. I was driven to dementia by psychiatric prescribing. I started shaking and howling, and my tongue darted in and out of my mouth. I could no longer stand still. I was given sleeping pills 3 times a day to control the agitation. I was given sleeping pills at night for sleep. I was then forced to have 25 sessions of bilateral electroconvulsive therapy. This therapy," in quotes, "was administered 3 times a week. It was like being sent to death row. I was terrified. I did not know whether I was going to die from lethal injection or from electrocution. After each therapy, I was totally confused. I had memory loss. I frequently had blood in my mouth. I had violent headaches. I had difficulty breathing. I developed a pronounced twitch in 1 foot. After each ECT session, my husband had to tell me where I was and why I was there, and to explain why I was being tortured. My husband was advised to find a long-term institution for me. I was released from psychiatric custody. I was told that I would require drugs for the rest of my life and that I would require weekly maintenance ECT also for the rest of my life. I tapered myself off drugs when I learned from a pharmacist that my adverse response to drugs was actually akathisia. That was 6 years ago. I did not go back for maintenance ECT. I take no drugs and I am not in a long-term institution. Psychiatrists destroyed my mind, my physical health and my emotional health with pharmaceuticals and ECT. After ECT, I could not find my way home from the hospital. I didn't know how to get into my apartment. After ECT, I lost almost total memory of over 20 years of my life. I have not regained much. After ECT, I had severe headaches, which lasted almost nonstop for several years. I still have pains. After ECT, my eyes were full of fireworks, flashes, floaters, and clouds. I have vitreal detachments. After ECT, I had heart palpitations. I still have them, though not as frequently. After ECT, I discovered damage to my teeth and to my dental restorations. After ECT, my legs tremored nonstop. They still tremor. After ECT, I had balance problems. I still have balance problems. After ECT, I had spontaneous seizures. I still have them, but less frequently. I feel weak. I lose consciousness. I collapse. I froth at the mouth, and my arms and legs spasm in all directions. After ECT, I had a prolonged twitch in 1 foot. It's still there, but less visible. After ECT, I had difficulty breathing. I continue to have the difficulty and have just been diagnosed with hiatus hernia, which interferes with the movement of my diaphragm. After ECT, I watched my husband collapse from grief, from stress, from guilt, and from heart failure. He had been informed that ECT was safe and effective, and he had been coerced. He had been coerced into giving approval. I breezed through high school and university. Post-ECT, I have difficulty learning new information. I put cork tiles on my home office wall so I can stick up notes which remind me what I am supposed to be doing and when. I solved the New York Times Sunday crossword with ease. Post-ECT, I am too distressed by cognitive effects to even attempt it. I was an avid reader. I often read a book a day. My memory was superb. Post-ECT, I have difficulty concentrating and remembering what I have just read. Photography was once my livelihood. Post-ECT, I can no longer use my camera because I can't figure out how it worked. Some psychiatrists try to insist that memory loss following ECT is actually because of depression. Common. I should say that's a common explanation from psychiatrists. I wasn't even depressed until antidepressant medications were administered. I am every woman and I am every man. What happened to me could happen to anyone. I will never be normal again. I am not in a long-term institution. I was once bright, energetic, creative, trendy, slender, and light on my feet. The wife who was returned to my husband post-ECT has brain damage and amnesia, is disorganized and clumsy, has tremors and seizures, has blurred vision, is overweight, and whimpers and sometimes screams in her sleep. ECT knocked out my soul, but not my spirit. Psychiatrists sentenced the wrong person to the electric chair. Any person sentenced to ECT is the wrong person. ECT must be discontinued. It is a dangerous procedure performed with a dangerous machine in dangerous hands. It has no place in the practice of medicine. And she ends it with, please do not reduce FDA approval requirements for ECT devices. That is the end of the statement from an anonymous person. And she is referring to the FDA hearings where they wanted to reclassify the ECT machines as safe, move them to class two. They do remain, fortunately, after the hearings last January in class three, which means hazardous. In Canada, ECT machines are classified as potentially hazardous. This is a weaker description of these machines, and you can see a photograph of the machine up here in the display table. I wanted to read this. I'm sorry if it upset some of you, but it is upsetting. When I read this, I was very upset to hear this, to know this. I happen to know the person. This person has a lot of courage to even write this. Can you imagine? Many people do not go public, as she has done, because there's so much shame associated unjustly with this medical procedure, with the psychiatric procedure. I've been privileged to be at conferences where shock survivors and public hearings have stood up and told equally horrific stories, and family relatives have also complained. And I will mention this when we get into the fight back, the resistance, the public resistance, which is snowballing, I'd like to believe, but it is increasing in the last 5 to 10 years. Now I want to just read some testimony. The Coalition Against Psychiatric Assault held public hearings because the province of Ontario refused to hold public hearings on this controversial procedure, the most controversial in medicine. And they refused. But they'll hold hearings for other things. So the Coalition decided we're going to do it. And it was just amazing. This is on DVD now. I'm glad to say the testimony of shock survivors. In Toronto, it happened in April of 2005. It's just 6 years ago. So I want to read some of the testimony from people who've given their first names only, and just give you a flavor. This is 6 years ago. Sue Clark, she's an amazing person in Ottawa who has founded the international campaign to ban electroshock a few years ago. Sue Clark was 17 years old when she ran away from a middle-class home after many years of physical and psychological abuse. What happened was she was forcibly electroshocked 5 times and tried to resist. Her heart stopped on the 5th shock treatment. They had to revive it. She suffers from, quote, permanent memory loss, and she finally asserts, quote, ECT is a brutal method of torture and crime against humanity. That's a direct quote. Sue wants shock banned. Wendy Funk, another friend and sister, in 1988, Wendy was a young mother in Lethbridge, Alberta. Although not depressed, she says she was prescribed Prozac and soon found herself in a psychiatric ward where she was drugged and electroshocked for 14 months. Today, she suffers from various disabilities, including memory loss and brain damage. Quote, this is a direct quote from her written submission. I returned home to a family I had no memory of. My social work career and law aspirations vanished. The intent of ECT is to kill brain cells. That's, I would very much like to move forward with my life, but it's been 14 years, and so far I haven't been able to. Quote, that was written in 2005. I'm very pleased to report, and I'm sure Wendy wouldn't mind my saying it, she's now an accomplished pianist, and despite her memory loss, and you have to remember notes if you want to be a pianist, be able to read notes, music, obviously, she passed with flying colors an examination here at the Royal Conservatory. This is a woman who persisted, but many are not so fortunate. But I met Wendy and she's amazing. Carla McCaig, who is a lifelong friend, in the mid-1960s, at the age of 24, with 2 children under 2 years old, she visited a psychiatrist in Hamilton, Ontario, for depression. After 20 minutes, the psychiatrist prescribed 15 shock treatments and told her nothing about the common risks of electroshock, including seizures and memory loss. Nothing. This is par for the course. There are other examples of people not being told anything, virtually nothing, about this procedure. Today, almost 40 years later, Carla suffers from permanent memory loss. She writes, and this is a direct quote, I think she wrote this in the 1990s, over 10 years ago. Huge chunks of my life are still missing. It's a quote. She also lost much of her ability to memorize and play classical music, although Carla has degrees in mathematics and law, and once worked as a lawyer, which is how I met her once, she says, quote, I am not as smart as I used to be. And this is from a brilliant, very brilliant person, and one of the first, one of the most respected mental health lawyers in Canada. She's co-author of the book Mental Health Law in Canada. Wayne Lax. Wayne lives in Kenora, way up north, Ontario. After his brother died, he became an alcoholic during a 20-year period until 1992. He was hospitalized 108 times. Once was prescribed, quote, 17 pills a day, close quote, and underwent a total of 80 electroshocks in Lakehead Psychiatric Hospital, where they're still giving shock there, I should add. As a result of the shock treatments, he suffers from permanent memory loss so severe he can't recognize other patients he once knew. Quote, they, the psychiatrists, treated us like guinea pigs. Why would delivering electricity through a brain be anything less than destructive and damaging? Good question. A statement. That's a quote. Jacqueline Guest, a career counselor. Today, Jacqueline was prescribed the antidepressant Zoloft because she felt suicidal in 1995. The drug triggered a manic episode which lasted 6 to 8 months and eviction. She then crashed dramatically and attempted suicide. As an outpatient at the Clark Institute of Psychiatry in 1998, Jacqueline underwent 38 bilateral shock treatments in 2 months. Well, that's about a shock every other day. Today, she can't recall any experiences, quote, between 1995 and 1999. Pre-1995 has been wiped out for me by ECT. Nothing before 1995. Did she remember? That's a quote. Although Jacqueline has a BA degree, she had to relearn how to write a sentence and the multiplication tables. This is after the ECT. Chris Dowling, and this will be the last one, example, then get into something else. Chris Dowling is a community mental health worker. While hospitalized for 2 periods, 1988 and 1998, at Homewood Sanitarium, Homewood, you know, that's in Guelph, for some of you may know, well, he underwent 3 courses of electroshock, or approximately 30 treatments. Although he claims he has no recognizable impairments, the treatments didn't help. He never consented to shock and recalls he once was shown a video about electroshock, but there was no scene showing people waking up from the treatment. Chris asserts, quote, ECT is an assault on my brain. ECT should be banned. In no way is it a healing option. And that's a direct quote. And that influence, his phrase, is no way a healing option, is actually the title of the report from Kappa called Electroshock is Not a Healing Option. And you can get this on the Kappa site, which I will write up shortly on the blackboard, at maybe during the break. Okay, so those are the survivors speaking out, and you won't find these kinds of statements in the Toronto Star, I can assure you, or the Globe and Mail, or the CBC, because as I've said before, and as I've written elsewhere, the shock survivors, psychiatric survivors, are not thought as credible when they criticize their treatment. But medical patients, I guess it's okay. They're more accepted, but there's still a stigma and a put down in the media. That shock survivors, particularly, are not thought as credible. In describing the procedure, I forgot to mention the long-term effects of electroshock. I told you about the immediate effects, the seizure, the memory loss, which generally most of it doesn't come back, much of it doesn't, despite what the psychiatrists say, the nausea, and and the weakness, the muscle weakness, the physical weakness, yes, and of course the brain damage. Brain damage is a long-term effect which the Canadian Psychiatric Association flatly denies, and I will tell the authors to their face that they are bald-faced liars, because there's been evidence for many years that this so-called treatment has brain damage. There are autopsy studies on animals. There are neurological studies, psychological studies that clearly show brain damage from most people. And the latest evidence we have from the most comprehensive study to date, the best one to date, with over 350 patients, is by Sackheim, Harold Sackheim, who's a psychologist, a research psychologist, not a psychiatrist, and four other colleagues. And he found out and finally broke his silence, because he was one of the big promoters of shock. You know, it's the greatest thing since Swiss cheese, you know, according to him, you know, it just helps people with depression, helps this person, helps that person. He finally came out and said, yes, memory loss can be permanent, finally, which means whenever there's memory loss that doesn't come back, it means some degree of brain damage. That's what it means. And he was honest enough to say it's mainly women and elderly women particularly who suffer the most damage, regardless of which side of the head is shocked. See, the psychiatrists sometimes say, well, you know, if you give it only on one side, then it's safer than if you give the shocks on both sides. That's BS. There is no credible evidence that people getting shocked on one side of the head have less loss or less disastrous than both. And by the way, most of the shock being given to today and for many years is when the electrodes are on both sides, bilateral. So the long-term effects, as you've heard from our sisters and brothers who've been shocked, is devastating memory loss. It's absolutely devastating. And if people come to you and say, well, I didn't have much loss, that however, they're the exception, or they find it hard to admit it, because if I had electroshock, I would find it hard to talk about it, too, certainly shortly afterwards. And to admit that your brain isn't working as you think it should, or you're hopefully, I mean, that's a hell of a stress that people have to face or choose not to face. And by the way, with every shock treatment, there is trauma. I mean, I guess you picked that up. I didn't specifically say it, but it's traumatic. One doesn't have to be an MD or PhD to understand that that amount of electricity going through the brain, and the brain only needs about 1/1000th of a millivolt or less in order to function. You know, you don't. And these psychiatrists are dumping all this electricity in the brain, thinking, oh, it's going to help people who are depressed and this and that. Well, all I can say is that there are a lot of people, more and more now, who are speaking out finally, and it takes a tremendous amount of courage, which we must respect and admire, to break their silence and say, no, you're wrong, the doctor. You hurt me. You hurt me. You harmed me. What does the Hippocratic Oath say that all physicians take before becoming a doctor? Do no harm. Do no harm. They swear it. Every time a doctor presses a button on a shock machine, he does harm, or she does harm. Of course, most of the shock doctors today are men, but quite a few are also women. But they're not speaking up. There's a conspiracy of silence. I am going to just go through the resistance. There has been resistance since 1982. Grassroots resistance, I'm proud to say, and I'm part of that resistance against this treatment and try to get it banned. Other medical procedures have been banned in the history, but not shunt. Why? Good questions. Maybe you may want to throw up. I'm just going to go through, and I made copies of this, the chronology of resistance against electroshock, organized by date, to give you an overview of how long the resistance has been going on. This is not recent. In 1976, neurologist John Friedberg published a book called Shock Treatment is Not Good for Your Brain. That's pretty clear. There's no ambiguity there. Friedberg, he lives in California. He's amazing. I wish I had met him. He wrote another article in which he documents brain damage. 1979, psychiatrist Peter Breggin publishes a book called Electroshock, Its Brain Disabling Effects. 1982, the Coalition Stop Electroshock in Berkeley, California waged a campaign to get it banned in Berkeley, which succeeded, but only for 40 days because the Supreme Court of California overturned it. But he got shock on the agenda during his municipal vote. It's amazing. It's the only time that happened in North America. It should happen here. 1983 in New York, a bunch of us were involved in nonviolent civil disobedience, locking hands, blocking the doors of Gracie Square Hospital, the shock mill, in one of the shock mills in New York City. We were all arrested. There were, I don't know, there must have been 9 or 14 of us, but we were released the same day. Just an intimidating tactic on the part of the cops. But nonviolent civil disobedience is a tactic used more and more. 1983, same thing in Syracuse during a meeting of the Conference on Human Rights and Psychiatric Oppression. Where we blocked the doors of Benjamin Rush Psychiatric Institute. The institute is named after the so-called father of psychiatry, Benjamin Rush, who locked his son up in an asylum, I should add. And we got a fair amount of publicity there, but we were arrested. 1983 City Hall Forum. That was the first time in Canada where a bunch of us, I wasn't part of the forum. Carla McKay was there. David Revel was there at the City Hall Council Chamber. And people were encouraged to speak out, and they did. And then the next day, we protested against the Clark Institute of Psychiatry, which still gives a lot of shock. 1983, in December, the trial, Mrs. T, a woman who was threatened by her psychiatrist after she refused to have shock at Hamilton Psychiatric. Her husband supported her right to refuse, and this went to the Supreme Court of Ontario, and she lost. She wanted, and the review board ordered 15 shock treatments, and she lost in court, but she was never shocked, because after the getting the publicity, I guess they got a little scared, some of them, and they transferred her to a doctor who wouldn't give her shock. So that was a success. That hasn't happened since. Mrs. T, it's in Phoenix Rising. Ontario Coalition to Stop Electroshock was the first anti-shock organization in 1984, where we gave testimony before the Toronto Board of Health, say, okay, you guys, please, you experts on the Board of Health, try the Stop Shock in Ontario. Of course, that didn't happen because only the Minister of Health has the power to order interference with the medical treatment in Ontario. But but we made a lot of headlines, I can tell you, and we beat the shrinks from the Clark because they said shots should be continued. And we were believed more than they were because there was a resolution by the board to put a moratorium on shock, to at least interrupt it and do more research. Okay, I'm gonna skip forward because I'm taking too much time. So there have been some protests, I'm proud to say, organized by CAPA, Coalition Against Psychiatric Assault, and during the last three or four years called Stop Shocking Our Mothers and Grandmothers. We've had marches, rallies at Queen's Park. I see some of you have participated in it, yes, and we're very proud of that. And they will continue because women, particularly elderly women, are the prime targets, and we have statistics to back that up from the Minister of Health. And Sherry DeNovo, the MPP, NDP, MPP from Parkdale, last year, 2010, introduced the first bill to stop funding electroshock in Ontario. Private members' bill, it's going to be tough to get it passed because private members' bills, not a government bill, have a rough time of getting support, but at least she's on our side, and she'll be on our side, I'm sure, for quite a while. So I'm sorry, I'll stop talking. Do you have any comments or questions? Yes, Julie.
Just before you stop talking, you said you had some stats. I'd be really interested.
Some stats?
Yeah.
I can tell you that roughly, approximately, in this, give or take 100 or 200, roughly about 1,500 people get shocked every year in Ontario. It's 15,000 in Canada. Of course, compared to the U.S., which has 100,000 plus people shocked each year, by electroshock, and that means, and that translates into roughly 15,000 shock treatments, 15,000 shock treatments a year. The reason, I have a reason to be approximate, because the collection of ECT statistics is so incompetent. There is no good collection method in Ontario for collecting accurate and reliable ECT stats. And I was charged $5,000 through an access to information. They wanted to charge me, get this, $5,000 to get ECT stats, which should be free. And I had to go through the privacy commissioner in order to get them. Anyway, the other stats, about roughly 68, yeah, as I say, 68 to 70% of women who get shocked are women. This statistic is consistent for virtually all in Canada, certainly in Ontario and California and Texas. I have statistics for California and Texas going, but not recent ones. Texas is one of the few states that admits that the memory loss in letting patients read what they're getting into, you know, a consent form, it says possible irreversible memory loss. You look at the consent forms, or they and trying to get you to consent in Ontario, and they're not so honest. Roughly 45%, and I may be off 1 or 2%, but that's all. 45 to 50% of people who get shocked are elderly women. You see why I call it ageist. It's a women's issue too. It's not just a human rights issue, but try to get women to speak out. Okay, so these acts of resistance are being organized. I'm sure there'll be another one coming up next fall, next May, near Mother's Day, from CAPA, the Coalition Against Psychiatric Assault. Ireland has been doing amazing work. They've got more resistance going on than we have. It's in the legislature. They have got some legislators, not just one or two, but interested in speaking out against shock in Ireland. I give a lot of credit to Mind Freedom Ireland. That's the name of the group, facilitated, organized largely by Mary Maddock, who was here in Toronto last year for Psych Out, which was a conference to to mobilize the resistance against electroshock held here, actually at OISE. So if you didn't come or didn't know about it, I'm sorry, but it was quite powerful. We had people from the States and from Germany and here, and we drafted a resolution against shock, and you can get copies here on the table.
I'm a survivor in about practically every piece of psychiatric assault you can have.
Right?
16 shocks in a row. I was given an ultimatum. You could either take the 16 shock treatments or go to St. Thomas to the forensic ward for severe depression and suicidal, by the way. I was told that forensic ward would be locked up and restrained. So of the two, I thought the shock was better. They told me that if I took the shock treatments, what it would do is it would wipe out some of the bad part of my brain thinking. They told me that, I'm going to get emotional, sorry, I'm in a wheelchair because of psychiatric damage, okay?
Take your time.
Had 16 in a row, one every other day, for, eight, you know, they were never literally every other day, but the weekends put an extra day in between. And after I'd had the 16, despite them telling me that they wouldn't send me to St. Thomas, they did anyway. And in St. Thomas, you're introduced to the posies, which are locked to your wrist and your waist for weeks. So your, it's a leather strap goes around your waist. Yeah. Ties your wrists like this, they're locked, and they're like that for weeks. You don't even get to release
weeks?
Your
you
weeks.
Weeks.
Well, I was in St. Thomas for 10 months. But you don't get the shock, you don't get these off, even get changed. They put you in one of those big horse blanket gowns for safety. Then they put the restraints on and they leave you like this.
Did they explain why they were doing that?
Because it was suicidal, it was to keep you safe. And, I'm out of the system. I got the best Clint Bell help I ever had since 2002, psychological testing, and it's hard to speak out because when you speak out, what they do is they just go throw a whole bunch of labels back on. But I have a very supportive family doctor, so when the labels get on, she goes and kicks them out again. So I feel safe at speaking, but they're like this, and if you read any rules about restraints, they're supposed to be checked every 20 minutes to make and allow
that's
you to
right.
move.
Yes.
They never do. And that's singles on the waist, and then if they do the ankles together, that's doubles.
Were you in 4-point or 5-point?
I was in, 4-point.
I mean, they had
wrist.
The wrist, and then they had, they tied you up, had
leather
something
belt
around
locked
your arms,
your,
and your legs?
Yeah, the leather belts around your waist.
The
things are to your waist like that.
That's torture.
And then they do it to your ankles. That's doubles. You have to walk the prisoner shuffle. And then if they really get concerned about your safety, they then tie you to a mattress. But I want to talk about shock because that's what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
With the shock, I had a whole year of memory loss. You've now got me curious about heart palpitations. The upper two ventricles of my heart has apparently got irregular heartbeat, but I can't get anybody to treat them until I prove I have. I go people around the circle, whether mentally ill, physically ill, and I have tardive dystonia and tardive akathisia and a little bit of dyskinesia. That's all from medications. And
these are muscle disorders.
Yeah, and that's why I can't walk.
Dystonia, yeah.
Yeah, that's why I can't walk, it's dystonia. It's just the unpredictability of the leg movements, I'm not safe.
Yeah.
I have no recall numbers, and now you got me wondering, because I didn't know.
About
like if
what?
I, you know, if someone gives me a phone number, or if I go and I'm looking at something on this page, and then I want to go and dial a phone number, or I want to go and repeat a number, for some reason, I can't do it. I can't hold it long enough to spit it back. Yet, when I was doing all this major testing, I got off all the medication in 2002. My brain woke up. I got really enthusiastic. I actually had to look forward to work and life, and first time in my life. I'm 51 now. But I went to employment supports and I asked about support to get working. So they did all this massive psychological testing after I was off everything.
When did they do the testing?
2002.
Can you recall?
2002.
So this is about nine years ago?
Yeah, I was finally free of the psychiatric system. The reason I got free of the psychiatric system was because of the wheelchair. I got kicked out. Mm-hmm. But the good news is that they did all the psychological testing for employment supports, and ODSP paid for it. And I have an absolute, frameable, wonderful report. No evidence of mental health, no depression, bipolar, schizophrenia, or my borderline personality disorder, labels that I've been with since the age of 10.
Yeah.
Medication doses, you mentioned 17, and I thought, wow, that's all. I was on 35 to 50 pills a day. But the shock treatments were actually given to me as a punitive method. It was like...
punishment.
Yeah, it was...
Did they tell you that?
Well, they told me that if I didn't clean up my behavior...
Did they threaten you?
Oh, they told me that if I didn't clean up my behavior, that they would have to restrain me and put me in the forensic ward.
Thank you for sharing. That's heavy duty, heavy
I'm
stuff.
I'm out of it, though. That's why I feel I can speak now.
Yes.
So, and
well,
I definitely totally support. I got pretty emotional earlier, too, but that's okay.
Well, appreciate, appreciate you doing this.
Vital. That's
speaking
out. If you go to a patient advocate, do you have any stats on what kind of outcome this comes?
Stats on outcome?
Outcome, if people go to a patient advocate,
oh.
What's outcomes, or do you know of?
I don't have it.
My outcome was that the patient advocate went, and then they said that she has mental illness, and she's delusional, and it cycled around. But I'm not sure whether everyone else gets that, because a lot of people speak highly of advocates. So I was curious if you had stats.
I wish there were some advocates here whom I know. Some of you may know as survivor advocates. She's quite Lucy Costa, who works at CAMH. She's an advocate there for patients. She works
patient
in the empowerment council.
Patient.
She might, you know Lucy?
Yeah, I know Lucy. I don't think she's a patient advocate. I think she's
She does advocate in a way when she gets some, or she does look into it. Although they have a patient advocate there from the psychiatric patient advocate who gets paid by the province. But she's with the Empowerment Council, which is supposed to be independent. I say supposed to be because I know that they work, the Empowerment Council of CAMH works with the administration to some extent, and to tell you the truth, it's not as independent as I'd like to see it.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody else?
Just out of curiosity,
yes.
When you talked about that lawyer woman in Hamilton,
Mrs. T.
Who was forced by her doctor, and
threatened.
When she refused, and her husband refused, they had to go to
and
court.
And her brother.
How is it that you, as the patient, lose your rights to
good point.
To your body and your mind, and
mm-hmm.
and also your supporters cannot fight the medical system
right.
or the psychiatric
system? All right,
very good
point. If people heard that about losing your rights, how can they override? At that time in law in Ontario, your refusal meant nothing. There was no protection in the Mental Health Act. It was that case, Mrs. T, that Carla McCabe, my good friend and lawyer, that she was sticking up for her right to refuse. No means no. Did you get it, doctor? However, now under the Mental Health Act, they cannot give you, not supposed to, unless they want to break the law, and then the Health Care Consent Act, the companion, cannot give you a treatment after you say no, unless, and here's the loophole, unless they declare you incompetent, incapable, meaning you don't know what you're doing, which is not the case most of the time, and you don't have, and your substitute decision maker, a person who will make decisions, make treatment decisions for you, if that person consents, then they can give you shock against your will. That was a key case because at that time, they could do what they want to, for shock. And by the way, shocking people without consent is the law in New York State and in other states. Yes, they can shock you despite saying, no, I don't want to. Sorry, we know best, dear. Just shut up and let us do it. There is a part of the law where they can do that, and not just in New York. That's why Mind Freedom International, which is a coalition of 100 different organizations, human rights organizations in the world, has made a distinction between force shock and other shock. In my opinion, all electroshock is given without real consent, because how can you give consent when you're lied to and they don't tell you the truth before they turn on the electricity? There's no such thing as informed consent in psychiatry, and I've said it and I'll stand by it, because it's up to the, okay, doctor, what did you tell Kevin or Lucy? Did you tell them that they're, did you outline all the risks like other doctors do? Huh? Did you tell them about the possibility of brain damage? Did you tell them about the possibility part of the memory is not going to come back? Did you tell them about alternatives to shock, that instead of shock, he could get some other treatment? They fail on everyone. The Mrs. T case was one, a landmark case, and I'm so proud of that, because a bunch of us were in court when that decision, even though a woman judge was saying that the review board, which is like a kangaroo court in all psychiatric institutions, had a right to order you to have 15 shock treatments. So the case lost there. The case lost there. But what happened next is interesting. Bob Ray, who's with the Liberal Party now, the Liberal, he was NDP. This was in 83. He stands up. He was an MPP, at least. He was
unfamiliar with the fact that ECT would happen without consent.
Yes.
And the same system has worked their way the place as well, of now having these lovely things called community treatment orders.
That's another thing.
Right? They've worked their way back into another place.
Thank you for bringing that up. You want to talk about that?
Informed consent. And I mean, informed consent is certainly, it doesn't have objectivity to it. In terms of if you're working with a person, i.e. a psychiatrist, who doesn't have a framework or an analysis that this is potentially something harmful, then what kind of information they're going to provide to you is now askew, right? I mean, we all bring our own biases and prejudices to whatever situation that we're in. So informed consent really is, I mean, this is where patient advocacy can really be an important piece. And psychiatrists don't generally believe in holistic approaches and alternatives.
That's right.
Mentioned.
I have never heard, and I'm waiting to hear someone say, have you ever heard a psychiatrist say, well, you don't have to have shock if you want to go to a peer group or go to Kappa, which wouldn't ever happen. But, I mean, if you want to go to
options,
you know, here's an alternative, a different treatment. I've never heard. If you've heard of a psychiatrist who offers you a choice, I'd love to know. They don't, because they think what they think best is the only thing, and it doesn't matter what you think. Because of the Mrs. T case, to come back to what Susie was saying, finally, the Mental Health Act now spells out, it didn't before, but because of the Mrs. T case, spells out in what informed consent exists. If you look at the Mental Health Act, which governs all psychiatric institutions, and the Consent to Treatment Act, which covers all treatment, so-called treatment, all psychiatric procedures, you will see informed consent is spelled out. It must be voluntary. This is for any kind of psychiatric treatment. A, it must be voluntary, which means the patient must not be coerced, threatened, okay? Although we've heard a lot of threats from women and others, I mean, that they experienced by male psychiatrists. The doctor must tell you the effects, the major effects of whatever drug or treatment or shock he's giving, whatever treatment.
The doctor must tell you some what thinks of the long-term effects and the alternatives. It's in the act, it's in the law. So every time if you hear of somebody, a doctor who doesn't meet the criteria of what informed consent is, he's breaking the law. And they should be sued big time.
Oh.
I'd love to see a class action case of informed consent. Mrs. T never got it. Thousands and thousands and thousands of men and women rights have been violated as you hear me speak. Because they're not told the truth. They don't know what they're getting into. They don't know what the drugs are gonna do. They don't know what the shock is going to do. It's not spelled out because the doctors are too patronizing and they don't think, well, you should know, you know, we have to have a compliant patient, yes.
There is no recourse even when you can demonstrate that you can bring out the Mental Health Act in front of their nose. And then show the medical notes that you have from your chart, showing that actual black and white proof, there is still no recourse. Because one, you won't get a lawyer that's willing to take on a case against the government, and two, I'm mentally ill, supposedly, except I graduated.
But I have to say, I have to say this to you. There are lawyers who will fight.
You're not gonna meet.
And I have a list of them. And if anybody wants a list, I have a list of four or five lawyers who know their way around, are aware of the obstacles and the politicking that goes on and psych wards and how to take doctors to court, some of them will not charge you much or may take, I can't speak for them. That's between you and the lawyer, but I do know some lawyers, and I would not mention this if I didn't trust them and check out their track record. Some of them are good. Not all, I'm just saying there are a select few that I have, and if anybody wants, who's in problems or has a relative or friend who's in a psych ward or is being threatened with shock or drugs, let me know and I'll email you the list.
What that patient was talking about was when they deem that you're a danger to someone or to someone else or to yourself, they can just go, as far as I know, they can just do whatever they want.
No, they can't do whatever. There is part of the law. The problem is it's not often enforced in psychiatry. If you're a psychiatric patient, the rights exist on paper. It's true. There is law under the Mental Health Act, which governs all psychiatric facilities. There are things that it's usually allowing them to do more than what they can't do. The way the law is expressed, there are very few rights, but there are some rights, like the right to say no, informed consent, but it's violated, as I was saying, every time.
Yeah.
And the doctors are getting away with it. Not in medicine. You know, if you have surgery, if you're scheduled for surgery, or a heart operation, serious like that, the doctor takes the time, you have cancer or whatever, God forbid, or whatever, he'll explain what this cancer pill is, what the side effects are in medicine, but in psychiatry. A lot of people are too afraid to speak up. That's the way it is. Because the doctors, some of them are intimidating, they threaten, but that's why we need advocates more. But the advocates I submit are often not doing the job they should be to protect you and help you get your rights. I know it's a broad statement I'm making, but there are many instances. So you need strong advocates. You never take an advocate for granted. The ones paid by the government are not independent. How can you be independent? I'm supposed to represent you in CAMH, and you're paid by McGuinty's government. So who do you think they're going to be loyal to? I mean, there is a split loyalty. When you're an advocate or a lawyer, your one and only responsibility is to that patient, nobody else. The patient advocates that are working at KMH are responsible to the head office somewhere that is, and they're all funded by the government. So in my opinion, they're in a conflict of interest and always have been. They're not totally independent. I don't care what comes out of their mouth. But I don't know if you disagree, it's okay. I mean, if you think I'm full of hot air, that is perfectly fine. I can live with that. But I stand by what I'm saying, that the advocates are in a conflict of interest. They're not only out for your benefit. And it's a damn shame, because I am talking about one of the most destructive treatments in the history of psychiatry, in the history of medicine, second to psychosurgery, which, by the way, has never been outlawed in Ontario. Mm-hmm. No, you cannot do psychosurgery on an involuntary. They make the distinction in the Mental Health Act. No psychosurgery or lobotomies for involuntary. Well, what is voluntary in psychiatry? Give me a break. In my opinion, there's no such thing as a voluntary patient. Only on paper. Guess what? I'll let you in on a secret, which very few people know. I signed myself in. I was perfectly sane, quote, normal. I did an experiment, a social experiment. I signed myself into a provincial hospital in this province 15 years ago. And technically I was voluntary. When I tried to leave, they said, nope, not unless you have a place to go to. You can't leave. I said, I have a place to go to. That's how I got out. If I didn't have a place to go to, I would have stayed there and been drugged. And I was getting very, very anxious when I was told.
And you weren't formed. You weren't formed into the facility.
Yeah. I think I was formed, but I convinced them to let me out because I had a place to go.
Well, I mean, the first form only lasts 48.
This is back in the late 80s. You know, you were mentioning the community treatment orders.
Very controversial, right?
Do people know about this? No. I guess everybody knows about CTOs.
Very friendly sounding name. That was very friendly marketing, the title, community treatment orders.
Oh, all of the horrendous stuff that they do is covered up with friendly sounding names. Anyway, people, thank you for coming
thank
and
you.
Sitting and listening and contributing, because even though we're not a large group, but I was hoping we get more, but I'm very pleased that you took time out on Friday night to come.